10 seconds, Super.
Kiss my hot lips.
I want you to hold it between your knees.
There's never a cop around when you need one.
You got a little pretty male thing.
Well, do you, Bunk?
I'm gonna nail you for picking your feet in hookups.
This cat Chef is a bad mother. Shut your mouth.
Welcome to Vintage Video's 12 Days of Christmas, where as a special treat this year, we'll be reviewing all of our Patreon poll options for December of 1973, overanalyzing what you've seen and spoiling what you haven't. I'm Patrick O'Reilly.
I'm Jesse Bayless.
And I'm Richard Wells.
And today marks the 50th anniversary of the release of Sleeper on December 17th, 1973. It was written by Woody Allen and Marshall Brickman, directed by Woody Allen, and released by United Artists. In 1899...
What? I'm listening, I swear. What?
It's not actually that impressive. H.G. Wells' When the Sleeper Wakes was published and told the story of a man who falls asleep for 203 years with the help of technology to awake to an unfamiliar future. Beyond the word sleeper and the duration of the cryogenic rest, the stories share almost no common elements, but multiple existing efforts to adapt Wells' story to film were shelved after the release of this film.
You telling me that H.G. Wells didn't write a bunch of obnoxious banter and put
no,
it
that's
in his
all
story?
From okay. the original book.
And have a zany score. He was in the author's notes, a zany score.
Zany, please. If movies are invented,
yeah.
please include zany score. One of the adaptations was supposed to be from American International, and the other one was from Time Machine producer/director George Pal. So it's a shame that one didn't happen. Although the American International one was supposedly like the expensive, like big budgeted version of this story. So that could have been fun too. While shooting the sperm sequence for his previous film, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask, Woody Allen had his first ideas of taking a shot at the science fiction genre. In the interest of taking the intellectual approach, he ran many of his futurist theories by science fiction royalty Isaac Asimov over lunch to rate their feasibility. Asimov connected Allen with another acclaimed sci-fi writer, Ben Bova, for consultation throughout the production.
Please leave me alone. <It's> like,
you're paying, right? Allen's original intent was to tell the story in two 90-minute halves, one focusing on the present of 1973 and one on the future. Allen was not a big enough name at the time for the studio to support this ambitious plan and urged him to just shoot the future half. Just make a movie about the future. We don't want to confuse people with just a regular Woody Allen movie and then one that takes place with the same character 200 years later. The budget was still a tricky subject because of the film's effects requirements. The lever-powered bubble cars, the fake flying, giant fruit and vegetable props, elaborate sets and costumes brought the budget to around $2 million after an already expensive action-packed final scene was scrapped.
But this all looks very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's cheap but seamless. I wouldn't say that there's anything that looks trashy.
I think it's consistent in its aesthetic, but it doesn't look high-end sci-fi at all.
No, not at all. Allen and Marshall Brickman landed nominations from the WGA for Best Comedy, and the film was awarded the Hugo for Best Dramatic Presentation. The British band Sleeper has admitted to taking their name from this film.
I also noticed that it has a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
What? That's
contemporary reviews, probably, yeah.
Is that the audience review or the critic review?
Yeah, critics aren't allowed to say that they didn't like a Woody Allen movie unless they're Armand White and they just get paid to lie. That's all he does. The opening titles play out as has become custom, with white text under a jazz score. The font is not exactly his now standard condensed or elongated Windsor font, which he would debut 4 years later for the opening credits of Annie Hall. The closest match I could find to this font is something called Jasmine UPC. The jazz music also features Allen himself on clarinet with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, who were paid $12,000 for their work on this film. But he's actually performing with the band for the entire score. Picture starts in the distant future as a man in sunglasses at night leaves his bizarre concrete house and drives away in a silent electric bubble vehicle. He meets with another man descending the spiral stairs of what looks like a small observatory. They discuss a limited opportunity for some laboratory work and will learn that these people are the scientific arm of a rebel faction who are thawing cryogenically frozen patients from centuries past as tools in their revolution. They fear someone is onto them, and the next patient must be thawed tonight. It sounds like if anything goes wrong, the plan is to simply kill and dump the patient, as has been their practice in many other cases. The subject they're thawing tonight has been down for exactly 200 years. When they slide him out of his chamber, we see he is wrapped tightly in foil like a baked potato. A team of doctors work tirelessly to remove the foil one square inch at a time, and they struggle to elevate his blood pressure. We learn from the patient's medical charts stored with him in the chamber that his name is Miles Monroe and that he ran a health food restaurant. He did not volunteer himself for cryogenics, but when he went in for a routine peptic ulcer operation, some complication left him unrevivable by modern science, but with future science, it's no trouble at all. It reminded me of the Simpsons Future episode.
Oh, Mr. Burns, we'll thaw you out the second they discover the cure for 17 stab wounds in the back. How are we doing, boys?
Well, we're up to 15.
Because Miles was submitted for cryogenic preservation by his cousin, he's expecting to wake up back in his own time. When he rises from the slab, he seems severely brain damaged, and their many attempts to feed or shake sense into him are fruitless. He flings their own nutritious blue sludge back in their own faces. Security is alerted to the lab by the commotion, and the scientists leave him alone for a moment to get him one of their uniforms to pose as a third, stupid doctor. Left alone, he eats a rubber glove, and when they come back, he inflates it from inside his mouth. The security guards enter the lab and ask about a recent power surge, but the scientists can't admit to having resurrected Miles and play dumb. Miles smears more blue food product on the guard's face, and they explain that they tested a beam on his brain and that he's still recovering from its effects. Wouldn't that be responsible for a power surge?
Yeah.
Just blame that. Miles rolls around on a motorized wheelchair, crashing into everybody's knees, while the scientists do their best to assure the guards that their actions here have been fully authorized by the state. Sometime later, they carry him out into a parked bubble car with an opaque plastic dome over the top to prevent passengers from even seeing where they're going. What is the logic of having this be opaque? I guess it's just to protect you from sun damage. Right. You just trust the car.
Yeah, I just assume the car knows where it's going.
Trust the fungus. Miles, still stupefied by the thawing process, struggles against them to avoid getting in the car, but eventually they muscle him into it. We see a shot of bubble cars moving in both directions on opposite sides of LA River, playing the part of a future freeway. They pull up to a bizarre futuristic home built on a pillar overlooking forest. This is a real home called the Sculptured House, designed by architect Charles Deaton, though it has since been nicknamed the Sleeper House. It's located on Genesee Mountain in Colorado.
That's got to be infuriating. I hope the guy was dead before that happened.
What, before it got called the Sleeper House?
Yeah.
Well, so what happened was he didn't even finish making it, so I don't think he cared a lot about it.
The movie Sleeper?
Yeah. He didn't even finish making this
movie. I'm just saying, as an architect, like I think I would be infuriated for my work to then be associated with, you know, a movie rather than myself.
Yeah. No, I think it was
Nakatomi Plaza.
And then you'd just be like, take it, Die Hard. You take that building. But wasn't that like the Fox headquarters building?
Yeah.
Last year, this house sold for $1.5 million at a foreclosure auction.
I imagine those kinds of houses are hard to maintain because...
Well, what happened was people just bought it and then owned it and then sold it without ever moving in until 2006. Nobody lived in it from the day it was sold the first time to 2006.
Well, it just might not even be that livable. I don't even know.
I don't imagine it is, but they said it literally wasn't even finished on the inside.
Ah.
That the owners had tried to do additional work on the place, but I don't think it was actually a livable home until 2006. One side of the building is a wide bay of windows, and through it, the two scientists who resurrected Miles watch him led on a nature walk. They discuss the meals he requested, and it's all health food stuff that his restaurant used to serve.
He requested something called wheat germ, organic honey, and tiger's milk.
Oh yes, those are the charm substances that some years ago were felt to contain life-preserving properties.
You mean there was no deep fat, no steak or cream pies or hot fudge?
Those were thought to be unhealthy, precisely the opposite of what we now know to be true.
They decide it's time to inform Miles when he is. The female doctor, Dr. Melick, leads him into a field, and their conversation is muted, but the scene is scored with more original jazz, and he just collapses when he finally understands. He takes some time coming to grips with the fact that the world he knew is totally gone.
And where am I anyhow? I mean, what happened to everybody? Where are all my friends?
You must understand that everyone you knew in the past has been dead nearly 200 years.
But they all ate organic rice.
They inform him that in the intervening centuries, a nuclear bomb was detonated by someone named Albert Shanker, and that this is actually a society that arose in the post-apocalypse. Albert Shanker was likely a reference to, at the time, president of the American Federation of Teachers. On top of all that, they inform Miles that they were not actually allowed by the government to resurrect him, and if they're caught, they will all be destroyed.
Look, you gotta be kidding. I want to go back to sleep. If I don't get at least 600 G's, I'm grouchy all day.
They give him a cigarette to calm him down, and he tries to reject it.
You smoke this, and be sure you get the smoke deep down into your lungs.
I don't smoke.
It's tobacco. It's one of the healthiest things for your body. Now go ahead.
It occurs to Miles that the stocks he owns are probably worth a boatload now, but I'd guess that a whole apocalypse might have erased a few companies. He specifically mentions that he bought Polaroid at $7.
It's actually a funnier joke now than it probably was at the time.
The last time Polaroid was $7 would have been around 1957, and at the time of the film's release, it was already north of $100 a share, but it plummeted to $30 within a couple years, and then crashed to $0 in 2001 when it ceased to be publicly traded. The male doctor, Dr. Tryon, sits Miles down and asks him to explain artifacts from the past whose purpose or meaning was lost in the apocalypse. The people are all fairly well-known historical figures from world politics and pop culture, and after a couple serious responses, he starts making up joke answers because he realizes he doesn't care and nobody can prove him wrong. One of the pictures is of Norman Mailer, the author who we just saw as Stanford White in Ragtime, where we mentioned that he was also previously brought up in Marshall Brickman's next script, Simon.
Which has some similarities to this
movie. A lot of them. Like, it feels like it was honestly just a sleeper sequel at first, and then they changed it. They show him a clip of then-President Richard Nixon, but mention that history retains almost nothing about him.
Some of us have a theory that he might once have been a president of the United States, but that he did something horrendous so that all records... Everything was wiped out about him. There is nothing in history books. There are no pictures on stamps, money.
At the time of the film's release, the Watergate scandal was in full swing, and within a year, Nixon had officially resigned the U.S. presidency. Next, Miles is shown an excerpt of Howard Cosell on ABC's Wide World of Sports, and the scientists have theorized that these broadcasts were a form of torture used against enemies of the state.
Yes. That's exactly what that was.
Howard Cosell had previously appeared as himself in Woody Allen's Bananas, providing color commentary live, in person, during the overthrowing of the dictator of a small banana republic. Sometime later, as they enjoy a meal together, the scientists introduce their robotic butler, Janice. He's just one of a fleet of domesticons that keep the home in order. They ask the robots to clear the table and then let Miles in on their mission. They need to investigate a secret directive called the Ares Project, which they believe is a plan to eradicate the underground resistance to the government. Miles is in a unique position because, by nature of having been born in the before times, he has not been programmed and registered in their system. If he worked as their agent, he would be a useless tool against them because he doesn't know any important details of the resistance.
But they could torture you for months. What could you tell them?
Only my name, rank, serial number, and your name.
Yeah.
Like, right away, like, I have information I could damage you with. I don't do torture well. I'm not Joe Spinell. I'm not Toradano. He's very hesitant to join their revolution, but the authorities arrive and he has to hide or risk execution here. He grabs a ladder and tries to climb it down to the ground, but it doesn't quite reach, so he has to balance on the end of it as he climbs down. The ladder is clearly strung up from both sides to balance it as he climbs down, but the scene is still very reminiscent of classic Buster Keaton moments. Inside the house, the scientists seem to be killed, and Miles steals a helicopter backpack from one of the security vehicles to escape in. The security teams are dressed in all red and try and fail to fire a rocket at him and then chase him on foot as he struggles to get the flying pack off the ground.
Goddamn cheap Japanese flying packs.
He ends up rising a maximum of 3 or 4 feet off the ground, but it's enough to stay ahead of the guards chasing him. They lose him when his propellers get lodged in a tree. The guards stop a truckload of Domesticon bots and ask if they've seen the fugitive, and Miles hides in the back with all their merchandise. He finds the remote control and extra parts and decides to disguise himself as another one of the robots. When another security team stops the truck, he checks the back, but by now, Miles manages to blend in with the robots, even without a faceplate and wearing his glasses, but he's painted his face silver. So I guess there's silver paint back here, too.
Yeah. He's got one of the mouthpieces.
Just in his mouth.
Yeah, this is the only thing I've ever known about this movie, was this image of him
pretending to be a robot.
To be the robot.
Yeah. Later that night, he is delivered to the home of Luna Schlosser, played by Diane Keaton, wearing a green face mask. They both watch a broadcast on television in her apartment announcing the escaped alien. That's what they're calling him.
They got aliens here too? Luigi, where are the aliens?
Whoa. Luna turns off the TV and announces a dinner party starting soon. She gives Miles a list of things to prepare for her guests, and he shuffles into the kitchen and tries to improvise an instant pudding, which quickly foams out of control, covering the entire counter. The pudding here is actually polyurethane foam, typically used as spray insulation in building construction. The guests begin to arrive, and one of them has a shirt with a picture of their dear leader. Another of the party's guests is Jewish comedian George Firth, sporting an inverted Nazi swastika shirt and a Jewish prayer shawl.
The best of all of these outfits, though, is the woman, and I don't know if it's part of her dress or just her necklace, but like the top string around her neck is made out of baby heads painted black.
I did not even notice that.
Like baby dolls, like That's just awesome. Make up the top of her dress.
That's perfect. Miles collects various personal effects from all the incoming guests and tucks them into what he believes to be a small closet, but the chamber is in fact an incinerator, and everything within is instantly cremated. Guest Harold presents Luna with a painting of what looks like a big-eyed refugee in a war-torn country. In order, Luna declares the painting to be Keen and then Cougat, future synonyms for cool, though Keen also seems a direct reference to American painter Margaret Keen, so famous for her big-eyed child paintings mm-hmm. that she was recently played by Amy Adams in Tim Burton's Margaret Keen biopic, Big Eyes. The follow-up declaration of Cougat is probably a reference to jazz musician Xavier Cougat. Back in the kitchen, Miles has briefly lost sight of the instant pudding and then notices it has come to life and he has to beat it to death with a broom. Back in the den, the guests take seats in a circle of beanbag chairs, and Miles, or Milo as they've nicknamed him, is entrusted with passing an intoxicating orb around the room. Apparently the user is affected by mere proximity, so Miles is quickly on the verge of passing out, and toward the end of the circle is fighting with the amused guests over possession of the hot orb. He's eventually so high that he sexually assaults one of Luna's guests, and she just laughs about it, and gets up to wander away when the rest of the guests move to the pool. Miles is left alone with the orb. Later, Luna and one of her guests, Harold, return from swimming and step into a cylindrical chamber called the Orgasmatron for an artificial sexual encounter. They moan inside for 3 seconds and then step out of it, finished. It reminded me of a similar machine in Jodorowsky's The Holy Mountain, released May of the same year. The Orgasmatron has also been compared by some to Wilhelm Reich's 1930 pseudoscience device, the Orgon Accumulator, which, according to him, offered all kinds of undiscovered healing properties. Luna and Harold discuss the arrest of a friend, Dalton Porter, who it seems was affiliated with the Underground in some way. The guest mentions Porter having raved about a secret hospital and the Ares Project, but Luna sides with the government, pointing out that everyone has everything they need, sex, drugs, television. She offers to read Harold her latest poem, and he's excited to hear it. It's very plain, but at the end she accidentally reverses the life cycle of butterflies to describe one turning into a caterpillar, and when Harold corrects her, she goes apeshit.
They change from caterpillars into butterflies, not the other way.
They do? They do? Damn it! Damn it! Damn it, I always get that wrong!
He calms her down by putting on the TV just in time for the end of the broadcast day, and they're both entreated to a wave goodbye from their dear leader, sitting in a wheelchair beside a dog atop a cliff overlooking the sea. They wave back for some reason.
This reminded me of, have you guys watched Severance?
I have not, no.
Oh, okay. Well, then I shan't spoil it, but there's a fun moment when there's like a completion screen and this like this fun image. And it's just like, it just reminded me of this.
I have to check that out. Sometime later, she takes Miles back to the factory to get his head replaced. Miles is obviously terrified to see the technicians bashing open robot skulls. And after waiting patiently for a weirdly long time, he finally makes a run for it. And we get a sort of fast motion Keystone Cop style sequence of everybody falling over themselves, failing to capture him. He rushes out the door into Luna's bubble car and admits he's the alien from the news, actually just an innocent man from the past, and he even shares his entire mission with her. She tries to scream, and he covers her mouth and drives them both out into the woods. Later, he has her bound and gagged in the woods, and when he ungags her, she screams a lot, but eventually calms enough to urge Miles to turn himself in for reprogramming. He asks her to at least escort him to the Western District, where he was told the Ares Project can be found. He offers to pay her in food, and then hikes to a nearby farm with enormous fruits and vegetables. Do you guys recall the last time we saw a farm with giant fruits and vegetables? Like as big as they are in this movie, or bigger.
Fantastic Planet.
That's a good answer, but I'm thinking of something earlier.
Heart Beeps.
Was there some in Heart Beeps?
Was there?
I don't remember them.
I don't remember now either.
Nothing?
I don't know.
First Family.
I still don't remember.
You remember the African nation that they're making a deal with where they're offering to give them white slaves in exchange for the secrets of their enormous produce?
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
It turns out it's just from radiation on their island.
I blocked that movie out.
Miles peels a giant banana for Luna, but a farm guard catches him and tries to apprehend him, and both men slip on the enormous banana peel over and over until Miles manages to knock the man unconscious with more giant fruits.
My God, I beat a man insensible with a strawberry.
This feels like, obviously there's a bit of 2001 in this movie, but this feels like a Clockwork Orange moment. Because there's the scene where they break into the woman's house to take her stuff, and then he beats her unconscious with a giant porcelain cock. And so that reminded me of this moment when he beats him unconscious with a giant strawberry. Because they're in like the same positioning and everything. Mm. On his way back to Luna with an enormous celery stalk and a banana under his arm, he sees another guard with a 10-foot-tall chicken, which supposedly chased him around in a scene cut for time. I would have liked to have seen that, though. Sometime later, Luna and Miles stop by a nearby home, and Luna keeps trying to drop hints that she's been abducted and eventually excuses herself to the bathroom where she can call the police to report Miles' location. The cops assure Luna they will be there soon. The homeowners here are a gay couple, and they have a stereotypically limp-wristed Domesticon butler to match. Luna asks them if they have a hydrovac suit that Miles can borrow so that the cops won't recognize him in a robot costume. She leads him to a nearby river, and when the cops show, she pulls a switch on his hydrovac suit to inflate it. I guess she thought this would make him easier to apprehend, but instead he's able to jump as high in the air as he did before with the flying pack. The guards, instead, capture Luna, and the same set of agents try again with their rocket launcher, but this time, instead of the gun exploding, the plunger explodes that controls the gun.
Every time we see these guys, they manage to do something to thwart their own efforts.
Yeah. The guards tell Luna that she's been contaminated by exposure to Miles, and it will be easier to just kill her than to fix her. But Miles circles back to rescue her, and they leave together. He invites her to use him as an inflatable raft, and when one of the guards hits him with a laser blast, his suit deflates from the resulting hole, and the escaping air propels them forward down the river. Hours later, they find a VW bug in a cave that is amazingly still in working condition. Judging from a bumper sticker, it was once owned by a Republican.
Register commies, not guns. What's that mean?
What?
Register commies, not guns.
Oh, he was probably a member of the National Rifle Association. There was a group that helped criminals get guns so they could shoot citizens. It was a public service.
It seems like a weird choice of car for a Republican
to own. I would think so, too.
Because I even feel like in the 70s, that's not the kind of person that owned a bug.
Yeah, but you have to remember, VW was complicit in the extermination of the Jews during World War II.
But peace and love.
Yeah.
It's a hippie car.
That's what they painted it like. For some reason, they drive the bug along the river for a while and then shove it off a cliff.
Yeah.
I don't get it. Like, they were already pretty far downriver, so this doesn't add to the story that they found a vehicle and drove it for a few extra miles. And it's not like they find this car as a clue to getting to them. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even know why this happened. Instead of helping him destroy the vehicle, she's asking him if he believes in God, but he doesn't seem to.
Well, I believe that there's somebody out there who watches over us.
Unfortunately, it's the government.
Somehow their explorations lead them back to the house where he was first brought by the scientists. Luna takes the opportunity to take her first bath in a while, and Miles takes the opportunity to shave in a futuristic mirror and makes an homage to the classic silent film era mirror gag, where a second actor, or in this case the first one again, pretends to be a reflection, a la Groucho Marx in Duck Soup. Miles accidentally changes the channel to other people's bathroom mirrors, and the woman on the other side is somehow compelled to shave to replicate Miles' motions until her husband shows up to ask about the man in her mirror. Later, Luna proposes a performance of sex with Miles, but he's put off by her wording. She's offended by his resistance, and then he kisses her. She asks him to join her in the orgasmatron, but he suggests they try the old-fashioned way. Suddenly, police have the building surrounded. He hides her in the closet full of 20th century artifacts, and then closes himself in the orgasmatron. The guards find him here shortly after, and he's back in his brain-damaged, freshly thought-out state. Later, he is dragged out of a drawer in what looks like a morgue wall, and a woman introduces herself as Dr. Nero, in charge of reprogramming him to the modern world. Sometime later, we see Miles on a stage acting out a Miss America pageant as a trio of technicians push buttons and spin levers in a control room.
What's the point of this scene?
I don't know.
Oh, there's so many scenes where it's, what's the point of this scene?
I mean, there are a lot of those scenes in here, but this one in particular just stands out to me that I'm like, I don't even understand it as a joke. Like, I don't even understand what's funny about it. Mm-hmm.
Somehow this is very fundamental to the way that their conformist society works. And so he's being told he's the prettiest, he's the belle of the ball, and he's buying into...
So this is his new personality being instilled. Okay, so when he leaves here and he thinks...
He thinks he's important and he thinks that he's valued by their society.
And he thinks he's a woman from Montana.
I don't know about that part. I couldn't tell you that much. I don't get why this is happening. I don't get why they pushed a car in the river. I don't get why a few scenes in a row so far. One at a time, the other contestants are excused from competition until Miles, Miss Minnesota, has won. Is it Minnesota
Montana.
Or Montana?
Montana.
Montana. Freshly reprogrammed, Miles is led to a costuming room staffed by two Jewish tailor robots voiced by Myron Cohen and Jackie Mason. Do you guys recall the last time we saw a robot voiced by a Borscht Belt comedian?
Heartbeeps.
Jack Carter was literally named Catskills in Heartbeeps. Miles' measurements are taken on a computer, and yet the outfit he gets is still way too big. Next, he's given a job feeding magnetic tape through reels and around sprockets on a wall as a potential homage to the physical comedy of Chaplin in his Modern Times film, where he's literally entangled in the gears of the machine. Finally, Miles is given a small apartment with another orgasmatron chamber. It also comes furnished with a book of friends and a promise of twice a week social gatherings, and I started to get angry that the film is calling this a dystopia. It's like, that sounds pretty awesome. Fuck you. As a placeholder on the way to his own Domesticon bots, he is trusted with a robot dog named Rags.
Woof, woof, woof. Hello, I'm Rags. Woof, woof.
Is he housebroken or will he be leaving little batteries all over the floor?
Back at work, he flirts a bit with his only coworker in the giant VCR room, and we cut to them enjoying a hot orb together at his place. In the woods, Luna is seen transforming into a wildling. She levels a bow and arrow into the trees, but accidentally lets go with the wrong hand and smacks herself hard with the bow. Doesn't look on purpose. When she swings like Tarzan out of a tree, she crashes hard into the ground. Here at least we can see her traded out for a stunt person, because I was like, don't make her do that. That's terrible. She stops to read a book when she is kidnapped by Erno Wint, leader of the underground, played by John Beck. We cut back to Miles as he literally offers a confession to a robot. He says he's been making love to his coworker and is instantly absolved of all sins. We cut to the guerrilla army in the woods, and Luna and Erno keep making flirty eyes at each other during meetings. Miles gets lunch at a futuristic McDonald's, actually the Mile High Church of Religious Science in Lakewood, Colorado, with a McDonald's billboard installed outside announcing over 795 sextillion served. That's 795 with 51 zeros after it. When he gets home, he finds Luna waiting for him in the apartment, but he's been thoroughly brainwashed and he doesn't remember her. He assumes that she's the alien he's heard about, and he calls in Rags the robot dog to attack her, but it does nothing. Now they have traded sides, and it's her turn to kidnap him with the help of the resistance and reprogram him in the woods. They reenact his life's greatest trauma. A dinner with his parents in 1962 when he informed them he was divorcing his wife Arlene.
She thinks I'm a pervert because I drank a waterbed.
Luna and Erno play Miles' parents as very caricaturey Jewish stereotypes.
Oy vey, I smear.
Oy, Javolt, what will them goyim say?
Miles is driven somehow into an impersonation of Blanche DuBois from A Streetcar Named Desire. And in response, Luna switches to playing Marlon Brando, with whom she had co-starred the previous year in The Godfather.
Again, I don't understand either of these scenes whatsoever.
I think that a big part of Woody Allen comedy is like that, oh, the more specific you get, the funnier it is. So it's like, oh, we're going to deal with my greatest trauma, which is, and then it's, you had dinner one night in 1962 where you talked about divorcing your wife, Arlene, and that was a big deal. Like, the more details you add to it, it's like makes it funnier. In his mind, it makes it funnier. But it's not funny. And the fact that he switches to Blanche DuBois just feels like he thought he had a good Blanche DuBois impression. It doesn't feel like it arises naturally from the joke of the scene at all.
I don't understand it. Like I feel like he thinks there's a joke there just because of the juxtaposition of him playing the character.
I think that's it.
And that's the whole joke? It's just not
jokes great. Were simple back then. They didn't have to make a lot of sense. It just had to be funny. Because it's like, but it's like, this guy is funny when he says these things this way, right? They plug him with a syringe, and when he wakes up later, he seems back to normal, or back to the way he was before he was kidnapped by the government. Luna tells him that she has become a whole new person in the woods with these men. She calls herself a wild animal, and a man tosses her a piece of raw meat, which lands in the dirt between them, and then Diane Keaton scoops it up and takes a big bite. Like, yeah. She actually picked up raw meat in dirt and took a bite out of it on the camera.
That's exactly what this looks like.
Unless it's like some set
cocoa
design.
Powder on a blanket.
Yeah, crushed bananas.
Yeah.
Painted to look like meat.
No, that's
it. Really
just,
does look
up
like
raw
meat.
Yeah, it
with
really
dirt
does.
On
and it.
It
looks like dirt, but maybe meat with chocolate powder. Sure, fine, I'll give you that. That still sounds gross.
She offers to play Miles a song on the guitar.
Rebels are we, born to be free, just like the fish in the sea.
This particular song was actually featured in Allen's previous film, Bananas.
Let us sing the song of the rebels. Rebels are we, born to be free, just like the fish in the sea.
Do you guys recall the last time we heard Diane Keaton singing a terrible song?
Was it The Godfather?
No.
We didn't cover that one.
We didn't?
Nice
I
try.
I feel like we did.
I don't know.
Because you're wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't even think of us covering a Diane Keaton movie.
It was pretty recent. Second to last movie of the season. Nothing?
I don't know.
Turn of the century activist.
Oh, Reds.
Reds, there you go.
I don't want to play in your yard. I don't like you anymore. You'll be sorry when you see me sliding down our cellar door.
Miles kisses her to end the song, but then minutes later stumbles upon her making out with Erno. She doesn't look embarrassed or caught, just excited to share the next plan of the resistance. Luna and Miles are provided with little thumb-sized condoms with fake fingerprints so they can sneak back into the hospital at the center of the Project Ares conspiracy.
It's just like Gattaca.
It's exactly like Gattaca. Miles is terrified they'll be caught.
Relax, you're shaking like a leaf.
Well, how do you want me to shake?
I did like that joke. I think that joke and the I need at least 600 years or I'm grumpy all day. Mm. Like those are the only two jokes so far that I was like. As they walk the halls, he admits to jealousy of her affections for Erno.
Jealous? Are you kidding, honey? With a body like mine, you don't get jealous.
Certainly, you don't expect me to tie myself down to one man. My love is a free gift to all the Bolshevik brothers.
Do what you want. You're over 21.
Do you guys recall the last time Diane Keaton's love was a free gift to all the Bolshevik brothers?
The Godfather.
That's it. No, we haven't covered that one.
Reds.
Yeah, that's right. They duck into the giant VCR room where he used to work. He wraps himself up in magnetic tape and then climbs out the window, entrusting her to remember the controls and lower him safely. The gag plays out like a deleted scene from Harold Lloyd's Safety Last. She pecks wildly at the switches on the wall until Miles manages to swing into the office one floor down and steal a pair of doctor's coats. He unties himself and walks back up to her floor with the disguises, and the tape room is now filled literally floor to ceiling with unspooled magnetic tape. They dress as doctors, and Miles ignores Erno's step-by-step plans. A traveling pack of doctors recognize Miles' fake name tag as Dr. Temkin, a doctor needed to perform a very specific procedure, and Miles and Luna have to follow the pack of doctors on a walk toward the operating theater. First, they stop into a small room where they learn the dark secret of Project Ares. Their dear leader was the subject of an assassination attempt, and all that survives is his nose.
Using great presence of mind, we rush the nose to our closest Delta laboratory, which is here, where, through massive biochemical effort, it has been kept alive for nearly a year.
Their intent, it seems, is to clone their dear leader from his nose material because the structure of government in the future is vague about the line of succession.
So, at this point, I was just like, okay, maybe this movie will do something interesting.
And he'll be the leader.
And he'll be the leader. Like he wasn't in a cryogenic tube. He was, like, somehow there was a mix-up, and he is the clone of the leader who will take control. I was hoping for something. Something to take this movie somewhere.
Nope. Do you guys recall the last time that members of a decapitated organization met in secret to clone their leader from a small organic sample?
I'm going to say Boys from Brazil.
That's right. The room empties to the OR where Luna and Miles plan to smuggle the nose out of the building. An enormous wall-sized computer supervises the cloning operation.
Hello, Dr. Temkin. So nice to see you. I'm BioCentral Computer 2100 Series G. I'll be assisting you through the entire process.
The architecture of the computer is also reminiscent to HAL, with a large green circle and a domed eye to replace HAL's small red pupil in a similar dome. The procedure will also be observed by all the hospital's higher-ups and a few younger doctors hoping to learn from this experiment. After a bit of pussyfooting around, Miles suggests postponing the cloning. He finally decides to sneak the nose out under his own face mask, but the supercomputer and men upstairs realize in unison that their leader is being nose-napped.
Something's going wrong. There's been a current break in the life support system.
Miles pulls out a gun and points it at the nose as a nostriled hostage, so they can exit the hospital unencumbered. Ask me if I said nostriled hostage like you're about to.
No, I was going to ask you if you wanted to just mush it all together and just nostriched. Say nostrich, and but thought nobody will get it.
It's too much like ostrich now.
Now, come in me. I'm warning you. He gets it right between the eyes.
He'll do it. He'll do it. I've seen him shoot a nose.
The doctors assume he's bluffing, so he pulls the trigger and a big bang flag pops out of the gun instead of the bullet that would surely have demolished Miles' hand holding the nose here.
But also, where did he get this gun?
It was in the house when they...
When he left the scientists.
Yeah, and he's like, I'm gonna distract them. Here, take this. And then he pushes her out to safety and gets captured.
Okay,
yeah.
So it was never a real gun at all?
Right. No, it was a gun that they had that was like, this is an artifact of the 20th century, and we have no idea what it is. And it's like, did you try pulling the trigger? Because then you would have known pretty quick it's just a prank gun.
Sorry, just thinking about Matt Berry and the IT crowd. There's a gun in this drawer. I wonder if it's loaded. He just puts it in his mouth and pulls the trigger. Nope.
He's so good. That makes sense considering how his dad went. He like gets up and walks out the window. They make a run for it and drop the nose crossing the street where it is suddenly crushed by a steamroller. The fugitives escape and the doctors command the steamroller to back up, revealing a giant nose flattened into a triangle the size of a large triangular tortilla. I couldn't think of another big triangle.
Wouldn't they be able to get the DNA off of this and clone from it?
Well, the nose was still alive. That's what's so weird.
I don't think they need a live nose to clone from.
I wouldn't think so either, but they made a point about it having
been given life support.
Yeah, that it was alive for almost a year now. It's definitely not alive now. But can a nose be alive?
Is the nose alive now versus then?
Doesn't like there's definitely no brain activity because there's no brain. It's just the nose. Luna's bubble car races through the woods, and the rocket launcher truck blocks their way again. This third time, the whole truck explodes instead of the gun or the plunger. Miles and Luna have successfully killed the government leader and escaped to freedom. Luna credits their success to Erno's brilliant plan. She thinks he might be the next leader, but Miles tries to explain the concept of absolute power corrupting absolutely.
Don't you understand? In 6 months, we'll be stealing Erno's nose. Political solutions don't work. I told you that. It doesn't matter who's up there. They're all terrible.
The argument ends with them confessing their love for each other. She asks, if he doesn't believe in politics, God, or science, what does he believe in?
Sex and death. Two things that come once in my lifetime. But at least after death, you're not nauseous.
which is nearly paraphrased as the title of Alan's next film, 1975's Love and Death, about Alan and Keaton teaming up to assassinate an evil dictator. It's the same thing they just did. The end. That's Sleeper, folks.
I didn't like it as much as I ever don't like Woody Allen movies.
It's not super funny.
No.
It's a very short jump from Jerry Lewis in terms of the depth of the comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's less slapstick and more just obnoxious banter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Dennis Miller, like the way that he'll just like rely on obscure references in place of a joke.
Mm.
Kind of like the Family Guy bit where they're like making fun of Murphy Brown, like blah, 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 Bishop Desmond Tutu, blah, blah, yeah, blah, yeah. blah. It's just like, who fucking cares? Like you said a smart word that I would get if I knew who this person was. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, and when there was slapstick comedy, it was just, you know, people falling down and then the score that was going crazy and kept playing Yankee Doodle.
Yeah.
Like Yankee Doodle. Was
yeah. I kept hearing bits of that.
It was like, what is this? I mean, I think it's cool that I guess they got a real jazz band and then he played music with them. But why this music?
Well, I think this music because this is a music that he actually likes. He is a clarinetist. Like Woody Allen actually plays the clarinet. And he wanted it to be closer to a silent film, but I guess he couldn't pull that off. Mm-hmm. So he made the Woody Allen version of a silent film, which is a lot of slapsticky silent film homage with these chase scenes or people trying to escape situations as a love letter to silent film. But the problem is that it doesn't commit at all to silent film for the other half of the movie.
Yeah.
It's not like what Mel Brooks did.
Yeah, exactly. I think that would have been a more interesting movie had it been a silent film.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. I would have liked it more if Woody Allen just never spoke.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a testament to the weakness of the dialogue here that it's like, it's just a bunch of random stand-up jokes squeezed mm-hmm. into the format of I'm a character from the past talking about the present and the future.
A lot of the scenes seemed to just be there to facilitate a joke.
Right.
Like it didn't feel like they were perpetuating the story. It's just like I need a setup. So here's the situation in which we set up this joke.
I just wrote a funny NRA joke. Where am I going to put this?
Yeah.
They'll find a conservative bumper sticker
on a VW bug
in a cave.
Yeah, that they don't need.
Why would they put it on a car that doesn't make sense?
Yeah. And some scenes just seem like, I just want to have fun with my friend. And like when him and Diane Keaton are pretending to get stuff started for the procedure and they're just like making up motions and smiling.
Yeah, you can tell it's
100% other.
Improvised.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's an hour and 27 minutes. It's one of those movies where it's like they were definitely stretching for time on this.
And it felt like I was like, it's only an hour and 27 minutes. Like when the movie was ending, I was like, okay, this was like 2 hours and 10 minutes long. It's like,
yeah, no, it definitely drags in places.
Well, there was chunks of it where I definitely put it in time and a half speed.
Right. But we're also, we are not the target audience for this.
Yeah.
I get it.
And honestly, the way his movies were built were supposed to be for the people of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't supposed to be as relevant to people 50 years later. So it's no surprise that we find it less amusing because these are not our references. So not that I didn't get them, but that because I didn't experience them in the context of the era, they are less funny to me.
I think it would have been funnier too had he not been making up jokes. Like it's like, oh, it's Joseph Stalin. He was like really into like stuff, and I like instead of
the first couple, he's just like, oh yeah, I really didn't care for this guy.
Like, yeah, but when he starts making up stuff, like, but he's doing it as a joke, it would have been funnier if he just genuinely didn't know.
Right. Yeah.
And he's giving them bad information because doesn't know.
It does seem weird for you to just make stuff up about a person that's not true. Like, oh, that's Charles de Gaulle. He like had a cooking show.
Yeah.
He taught people how to cook, and it's like, who is that joke for? Like people who know that Charles de Gaulle didn't have a cooking show? Mm-hmm. And is the joke really as simple as that's not what he did, but you just said that's what he did?
Yeah. I mean, that's the depth that I get from it. Yeah. So, but I don't
It doesn't
know if
seem like there's another
to
level
it.
To it than that. It's just like, ha ha ha, that's such not what he did that I laugh.
Yeah. I feel like I get really mad at Woody Allen dialogue because he seems like the kind of comedian that does a lot of self-deprecating humor, but is in fact very full of himself.
Sure, yeah.
And that just makes me very angry.
Yeah.
I do want to take that clip of him saying, I'm getting a divorce because she thinks I'm a pervert, and just like, that's it. Right there. That's it. That's the clip.
Oh, there's much worse stuff. There's a line in Bananas where he jokes about how he's like...
doing a sociological study on perversion. I'm up to advanced child molesting.
There's weird shit in all of his movies where he just blatantly calls himself out. I think we had a line in Stardust Memories where he's literally going into the apartment with his girlfriend and she's mad at him because he's been flirting with her daughter.
She's not even 14. She's 13 and a half.
I used to play those games with my father, so I know. I've been through all that.
What kind of games? You think I'm flirting with your kid cousin?
You can't take your eyes off her.
But she was sitting opposite me.
You smile at her.
This feels like a very specific argument that you had in real life that you wrote down.
Well, it's going to be a thumbs down for me. Sorry.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's for sure a thumbs down.
I'm still giving it a thumbs up, actually.
Of course.
Why?
I really
like it's Woody
Allen. I give it a thumbs up because the aesthetic is very consistent and it actually fits with the rest of his filmography. It feels like a Woody Allen movie. It feels like he actually put in the work to make it, like every frame of this looks the way he wanted it to. None of it feels half-assed. And except for the writing, but I still think there's some really funny imagery in here, and there were enough jokes that I laughed at that I'm like, all right, you get a point.
I can honestly say there's not too many Woody Allen movies that I do like.
I usually like the ones that weren't supposed to be funny, like Interiors, the ones that are very dramatic, like interpersonal stories.
I really like The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Sure, yeah.
I think that movie is is very quirky and fun and weird. And
I think I've only seen whichever version they played on Comedy Central all the time.
Mm.
I don't know why that was a regular Comedy Central movie, but it definitely was. A writer, director, and musician and actor was Woody Allen, who played Miles Monroe in the film. Obviously, he directed Manhattan, Annie Hall, Crimes and Misdemeanors. My favorite movie was Interiors of his, but a lot of people didn't like it, and Stardust Memories was kind of a response to that, where it was like a director that was mad that he tried to make a serious movie and nobody liked it. Between Annie Hall in 77 and the present, he has directed at least one feature film every year, except for 81 and 2018. He's married to Soon-Yi Previn, his ex-girlfriend Mia Farrow's adopted daughter. The writer here was Marshall Brickman. This was his first feature credit. Later, he writes Annie Hall and Manhattan on the way to Simon, which we covered last year. Later, he writes The Manhattan Project and Manhattan Murder Mystery to wrap up his Manhattan trilogy. Cinematographer David M. Walsh, he previously lit Evel Knievel and Allen's Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask. This was his second and final collaboration with Allen. Later, he lights The Sunshine Boys, Murder by Death, Roller Coaster, The Goodbye Girl, Foul Play, and so far on the show, Hero at Large, Private Benjamin, Seems Like Old Times and Only When I Laugh. Later, he lights Johnny Dangerously and Summer School. The editor here was O. Nicholas Brown. Later, he cuts The Man with One Red Shoe, Rambo 3, Tremors, City Slickers, Sleepwalkers, Free Willy, Hearts and Souls, In the Army Now, The Phantom, and 10 Things I Hate About You. Another editor here is Ron Kalish, not to be confused with Max Kalish from yesterday's film. He previously cut Bananas, and later Love and Death, and even later Sleepaway Camp. And the third credited editor here is Ralph Rosenblum, who previously cut Failsafe, 1,000 Clowns, The Night They Raided Minsky's, The Party at Kitty and Studs, and Bananas. Later, he cuts Love and Death, Annie Hall, Interiors, the 1983 Stuck on You, which is not a Farrelly Brothers movie. Diane Keaton played Luna Schlosser. We just had her moments ago in Reds. She was in a relationship with Allen prior to working with him in film and comes back for Love and Death, Annie Hall, Interiors, Manhattan, among many other titles. Her first major film role was as Kay Adams, fiance of Pacino's Michael Corleone in The Godfather. After this, she appears in Baby Boom, Father of the Bride, First Wives Club, and Something's Gotta Give. But she's probably best known for her 2021 appearance in the music video for Justin Bieber's song Ghost, wherein she plays Bieber's grandmother. John Beck played Erna Wint. This guy's just gorgeous. I gotta say it. I gotta mention it. We saw him last as Larry Douglas in The Other Side of Midnight. He was Moon Pie in Rollerball, Bill Templeton in Audrey Rose. He's also Mark Grayson in Dallas, and he voiced The Punisher on the mid-90s Spider-Man series. Mary Gregory played Dr. Melick. She was famously Eileen Kennedy in The Assassin, the season one finale of MacGyver. John McLean played Dr. Aegon. He was Boss Keen in Cool Hand Luke and Orval in First Blood next season. Muse Small played Dr. Nero. That's the girl who pulls him out of a drawer. She's Candy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That's the prostitute that McMurphy sets up with Billy Babbitt for the night. We've seen her as Doris in Fade to Black, and we heard her in American Pop. She's back next season as Mrs. Springborough in Zapped. Jessica Raines played the woman in the mirror who's mad that her reflection has been replaced. We've seen her now in Little Miss Marker, Oh God Book 2, and Honky Tonk Freeway, and she is the daughter of Claude Raines. Brian Avery played Harold Cohen. He was Carl Smith, the Baxter in The Graduate. If you're not familiar with what a Baxter is, then you need to go check out The Baxter, because that's a fantastic film directed by Michael Showalter. Spencer Milligan played Jeb Hrmthmg. It's spelled H-R-M-T-H-M-G. That's how you spell his last name. He was Rick Marshall in 30 episodes of Land of the Lost, the role played by Will Ferrell in the feature film adaptation. Regis Cordick played Party Guest, uncredited. He was the voice of Quintesson Judge in Transformers, the series and animated film. Howard Cosell played himself. He was the host of The Wide World of Sports. He was a sports journalist for ABC for a long time, famously impersonated by Billy Crystal, among many others. George Firth played another guest at Luna's party. Before this, he was Woodcock in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He's Charlie Flager Jr. in Myra Breckinridge and Van Johnson in Blazing Saddles. We've seen him now in Airport 77, The Cannonball Run, and he's back next season in Megaforce and Young Doctors in Love. Seaman Glass played Guard, uncredited. He was Mr. Watkins in Amy. Jerry Hardin played Cryogenic Lab Doctor. We get that one shot of him, like, from the POV of the patient thawing out. We saw him last in Reds, and before that as the governor in Honky Tonk Freeway. Later, he's Snuffy in the unrelated Honky Tonk Man next season. He shows up in Cujo, Falcon and the Snowman, and Starman. But for my money, he will always be either Deep Throat from X-Files or the attorney from the start of Big Trouble in Little China trying to get Egg Shen to squeal on Jack Burton.
If you're protecting Jack
you
Burton...
You leave Jack Burton alone!
Harry Holcomb played Reprogramming Technician. He was Captain Malone in Escape to Witch Mountain and Harry Thompson in Empire of the Ants. We saw him last as Man in Restaurant in The Other Side of Midnight. You remember Man in Restaurant?
Of course.
Jackie Mason was Robot Taylor voice, uncredited. After this, he shows up as Harry Hartunian in The Jerk. We saw him last as Jew Number 1 in the Spanish Inquisition segment of Mel Brooks' History of the World Part 1. Is that one of the guys that's like in the wall that's talking about playing ping pong with his balls?
Yeah.
Later, he's Jack Hartunian in Caddyshack 2, sort of standing in for Rodney Dangerfield. Some of his best work was voicing Rabbi Hyman Krustofsky in a dozen episodes of The Simpsons, one of which landed him a Primetime Emmy Award. Good for you. Albert Popwell played Reprogramming Scientist. We just saw him 2 days ago in his second of four Dirty Harry films. He's also Randolph Percy in Charlie Varick. But as soon as I saw him turning the knobs, I was like, that looks like Albert Popwell. Whitney Rydbeck played Janice. That was the robot at the scientist's house. Whitney Rydbeck played Daffy in 1941. He was Roy in Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives. And we've seen him so far in The Baltimore Bullet and Battle Beyond the Stars. I think that's everything for Sleeper. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, you can find all our socials at linktree.com/vintagevideopod. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll join us tomorrow when we'll be discussing Day of the Dolphin, which IMDb describes like so. A marine biologist teaches his dolphins to communicate in English, but shady characters plan to kidnap the trained mammals for a more sinister purpose. Ooh, they don't even mention it in the summary. We leave you now with the trailer for Day of the Dolphin.
Imagine that your life is spent in an environment of total physical sensation. That every one of your senses has been heightened to a level that in a human being might only be described as ecstatic.
Joseph E. Levine presents George C. Scott in a Mike Nichols film, The Day of the Dolphin.
His brain is as big as a man's. It processes information about two worlds, the world of water in which he is born and feeds and reproduces and dies, and the world of air in which he breathes.
Is it possible that dolphins are as intelligent as we are?
Well, that depends on your definition of intelligence.
What about the experiments of the military?
I don't know anything about the military.
What about their speaking in English?
I beg your pardon?
First month, first year.
Alpha speaking. In his own language, of course.
I want to visit Jacob Terrell's Marine Biology Center.
Second month, second year. 13 months to isolate the clicking patterns from the squeaks and the whistles and the groans.
The fact is, Dr. Terrell does not want visitors.
Is he hiding something?
Seventh month, second year. My first phone in.
Terrell tell you not to talk to me?
What?
Did he tell you not to give me any information?
Fourth year. Here comes our first morpheme. Phoneme P plus phoneme A equal...
Pa!
You've had quite a day, haven't you?
Pa.
Pa?
Pa!
Why does Fa speak?
Fa speak!
Yes. Why Fa speak? He does it for me. Why does Fa speak to Pa?
Pa! No! Pa!
You're sneaking up on us. Looks like we're going to be forced to come out with the information first to keep this whole thing from turning into some kind of freak show.
I want you to know that the equipment we borrowed is in fine shape, and it'll be returned to you very soon if nothing interferes with it.
Where are they? The dolphins. I would guess they're on that yacht. What are they going to do with them? That's the part we don't know. What we do know is that they've been working on this thing since you started teaching your friend Alpha to talk.
How do we stop them?
Unwittingly, he had trained a dolphin to kill the President of the United States.
Can you find B?
Find B!
Stop B! The thing on B's back will hurt me.
Find
B! Stop B now!
George C. Scott, in a Mike Nichols film, The Day of the Dolphin.